Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Story 1. I've lived in the Netherlands my whole life, about an hour's drive from Waardenburg. My grandfather used to tell me stories about that castle, the legend of Faust and Joost dragging him to hell. I never believed in those old tales, but I never dared to laugh at them either. People in our town treated the castle like a wound that never healed, speaking of it only in whispers, as if the place might hear and take offense. I never thought much about it until last winter. My cousin Alex came to visit from the States, and he thought the whole thing was hilarious. He wanted to see the castle for himself. "Come on," he said, half drunk after dinner one night. "What's the worst that could happen? It's just some old rocks. I mean, the devil dragging a guy to hell? Sounds like a bad horror movie." I didn't want to go. It was freezing out, and I told him the roads would be icy, but he wouldn't shut up about it. Finally, I caved just to get him off my back. We bundled up and headed out. The castle sits by the river, surrounded by marshy fields. The road to it is long and narrow with no streetlights. By the time we got there, the wind was howling, and the moon was hiding behind thick clouds. The place looked worse than I remembered, just a black silhouette against the sky, jagged and broken in places, like it was gnawing at the night. The gate was rusted shut, but Alex climbed over like it was nothing. "Come on, don't chicken out now," he called, grinning down at me. I cursed under my breath and followed. Inside, it was even darker. The air smelled damp and rotten, and every step we took echoed like we weren't alone. Alex had brought a flashlight, but it wasn't much help. The beam barely cut through the shadows, just enough to show the cracked walls and piles of debris. "Let's find Faust's room," Alex said, like we were on some kind of treasure hunt. "I don't think this is a good idea," I told him. "What, are you scared of ghosts?" he teased. I didn't answer. We climbed a narrow staircase, the steps creaking under our weight. At the top, there was a long hallway with doors on either side, most of them hanging off their hinges. Alex picked one at random and shoved it open. "This must be it," he said, stepping inside. The room was empty, just a square space with a broken window on one side. The wind blew through, cold and sharp, rattling the glass that was still clinging to the frame. Alex swept his flashlight across the walls, and that's when we saw it. The stain. It was dark, almost black, and spread across the floor in a jagged, uneven shape. It looked like someone had tried to scrub it away, but no amount of effort could erase it completely. "Dude, that's just mold," Alex said, though his voice had lost some of its cockiness. "It's blood," I whispered. He laughed, but it sounded forced. "Yeah, sure. Blood that's been here for, what, 500 years? Come on." But neither of us moved closer. The wind picked up, slamming the door shut behind us with a bang. I jumped, my heart pounding in my chest. Alex swung the flashlight around, but the beam flickered like the batteries were dying. "Stupid thing," he muttered, smacking it against his palm. Then we heard it, a scraping sound, low and slow, like metal dragging across stone. It came from the corner of the room, where the shadows were deepest. "What the hell was that?" Alex whispered. I didn't answer. I couldn't. My mouth was dry, and my legs felt like they were made of lead. The sound came again, louder this time, and something moved. Just a flicker of motion, barely visible in the dim light. Alex stepped closer, raising the flashlight, and that's when it lunged. It was fast, faster than anything I'd ever seen. A shape, dark and twisted, slammed into Alex and knocked him to the ground. The flashlight skittered across the floor, spinning wildly, its beam flashing in and out of the shadows. "Help me!" Alex screamed, his voice high and panicked. I froze. My brain was screaming at me to run, but my feet wouldn't move. I could barely see what was happening, just flashes of Alex struggling, his hands clawing at something I couldn't make out. It was like the shadows themselves were attacking him, wrapping around him, pulling him down. Then the screaming stopped. The room went silent, except for the wind howling through the broken window. The flashlight had stopped spinning, its beam pointed at the far wall. Alex was gone. I don't remember running. One second I was standing there, and the next I was outside, stumbling through the snow. I didn't stop until I reached the car. My hands were shaking so badly I could barely get the key in the ignition. I drove straight home and locked every door and window in the house. I didn't sleep that night, or the next. When the sun came up, I went back to the castle with a group of locals. I didn't tell them everything, just that Alex had gone missing, and I thought he might still be there. We searched the entire place, but there was no sign of him. In Faust's room, the stain on the floor looked darker than before, like it had been freshly made. We called the police, but they didn't find anything either. Officially, Alex is still listed as missing. Unofficially, I know the truth. I haven't been back to Wardenburg since. I don't think I ever will. Story 2. I grew up in a small town in southern Chile near the Rio Bueno. My name's Ernesto, and I work as a mechanic. Though back then, I just turned 23 and was helping my uncle repair boats. Our town wasn't anything special. Dirt roads, old houses with peeling paint, and a church at the center. Life was quiet, maybe too quiet, but I liked it that way. One summer evening, I went to the riverbank to fish. Fishing had always been my way of unwinding after a long day. The Rio Bueno was calm that time of year, and the air smelled like damp earth and reeds. It wasn't far from my uncle's shop, so I usually grabbed my pole and walked down there just before sunset. That night the river was still, and the sun was sinking low, painting the sky orange and pink. I found a spot a little farther from where the kids usually swam, near a bend where the water got deeper. It was a good place, quiet with no one around. I cast my line and settled in, letting the sound of the river and the rustling leaves wash over me. After a while I heard laughter, high-pitched like a child's. At first I thought it was one of the neighbor kids playing by the shore, but when I looked around, I didn't see anyone, just the water, the rocks, and the tall grass. The laughter came again, faint but clear, and it gave me a strange feeling. It wasn't playful exactly. It sounded wrong. Too light, too airy, like it wasn't coming from a real throat. I shook it off and focused on my fishing. The sun was dipping below the horizon now, and the colors of the sky were fading into gray. The river started to feel colder, and a light mist was forming on the surface. That's when I saw it. At first, I thought it was a large piece of leather drifting down the river, a cowhide maybe that someone had tossed in. It was dark, slick, and the edges rippled like it was caught in the current. But the river wasn't moving fast enough for that, and this thing wasn't floating. It was swimming. I leaned forward, squinting to get a better look. It was about 20 feet out, gliding against the flow of the water. The edges of it flicked upward, like fins or the hem of a skirt. And I swear I saw something underneath it. Shapes moving, twisting, almost like arms. I froze. My gut told me to leave, but I couldn't move. It didn't make sense. It was just a cowhide, I told myself. Just some trash washed down from upstream. But then it turned. It turned toward me. The thing slid closer, and as it did, the water around it seemed to darken. The laughter came again, louder this time, and I swear it was coming from underneath the thing. "Quién anda ahí?" I called out, my voice shaking. It stopped. The hide lay still on the surface, rippling gently like it was breathing. And then, it started to rise. Two long, thin arms reached out from underneath the hide, dragging themselves across the water. They were too pale, almost translucent, and ended in hands that didn't look human. The fingers were too long, bending in ways they shouldn't. One of them slapped the surface, making a sound like wet meat hitting the ground. I backed up, my heart pounding so hard it felt like it would burst out of my chest. My fishing pole was still stuck in the rocks, but there was no way I was going back for it. The thing crawled closer, its arms pulling it forward while the hide rippled over its back like a second skin. And then I saw the head. It was barely above the water, but I saw it, gray, round and flat, with no eyes. Just a slit of a mouth that stretched too wide, grinning as it came closer. "No!" I shouted, stumbling back up the bank. The thing stopped. It tilted its head, or whatever part of it that was supposed to be a head, like it was listening. And then slowly, it sank back into the water, disappearing beneath the surface without a sound. I didn't wait to see if it would come back. I ran. I ran faster than I ever had in my life, all the way back to my uncle's shop. I didn't look back, not even when I tripped and scraped my knee on the gravel. When I burst through the door, my uncle looked up from his workbench. "What happened to you?" he asked, staring at the sweat dripping down my face. I tried to tell him, but the words wouldn't come out. All I could do was point toward the river, shaking my head. He frowned, walked over, and poured me a shot of Pisco. "Drink this," he said, and calm.
Mondays just got better at El Vaquero. Every kid's meal now comes with a free slushie when you dine in, and there's no catch. Just a little something sweet to start off your week. No more manic Mondays. Make dinner easy and delicious with El Vaquero. Enjoy fresh, flavorful dishes and a cool treat for the kids. Turn Mondays into family fun night, or better yet, Taco Monday at El Vaquero. It's all about family, flavor, and fun. Check out the menu and plan your visit at Vaquero Restaurant.
In this time of financial instability, create your own personal safety net by using the equity in your home to secure a home equity line of credit. It'll give you immediate access to money whenever you need it, whether it's for a fun project or a big purchase, or in case you fall on hard times. And for a limited time, you can lock in a 1.99% introductory APR for 6 months at Kemba Financial Credit Union. Give yourself peace of mind. Apply now at Kemba.org. APR equals annual percentage rate. Federal insured by NCUA. Equal housing lender. Offer ends September 30th. NMLS 292230.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Down. I did, and when I finally told him what I'd seen, he just stared at me for a long moment. Then he nodded like he wasn't surprised. "El Cuero," he said quietly, "I've heard the stories, but I never thought..." "Well, you're lucky, Ernesto. It usually doesn't let people go." I didn't sleep that night. I never went back to that part of the river again. Story 3, I live in Luck now, not too far from the residency area. My house is one of those old, crumbling javelis, and growing up, I'd heard countless stories about the 1857 uprising. Every old-timer has some chilling tale to tell about that time, but what always fascinated me were the tunnels under the city, the ones connected to the royal palace. Everyone knows the story, how the king and queen fled through them, and the British soldiers who followed them inside never came out. The entrances were sealed, and no one dared to open them. At least not until someone did. This happened back in 2013. I was 24, working as a photographer for a small local magazine. We were doing a piece on the hidden history of Lucknow, and someone suggested we include the palace tunnels. Of course, they were still sealed, but the caretaker of the palace claimed he had access to an unblocked passage that most people didn't know about. My editor was thrilled. I wasn't. I don't know how to explain it, but I'd always had this uneasiness about the tunnels. Every time I'd walk past the barricaded entrances, I'd feel this cold, prickling sensation on the back of my neck, like someone was watching me. But I couldn't exactly say no. So I grabbed my camera and went. The caretaker, an old man named Shaber, met me outside the palace. He was thin and wiry, with a voice that trembled like dry leaves in the wind. "You shouldn't be here," he said quietly as he unlocked the gate. "These tunnels, they're cursed." I laughed it off, but his expression didn't change. "I'm serious," he said. "No one who enters these tunnels comes back the same, if they come back at all." "Then why are you showing them to me?" I asked, trying to sound braver than I felt. He hesitated, then muttered something about needing the money. I didn't push further. The entrance was a narrow arched doorway hidden behind a thicket of overgrown shrubs. Shabir handed me a flashlight and warned me not to wander too far. "Stay close to the main tunnel," he said, "and don't touch anything." The air inside was thick and stale, and the walls were damp with moisture. The further we went, the darker and quieter it got. My footsteps echoed, but it felt wrong, like the echoes didn't match the rhythm of my steps. I kept telling myself it was just my imagination, but my nerves were already shot. About 10 minutes in, we reached a fork in the tunnel. Shabir stopped and pointed to the right. "This is as far as I go," he said. "You can explore that way. But remember, stay on the main path." I asked him why he wouldn't come with me, but he just shook his head. "You wouldn't understand," he said, backing away. "I'll wait outside." I didn't argue. Part of me was relieved to be alone. His nervous energy was starting to get to me. I switched on my flashlight and headed down the right tunnel. The walls were lined with carved patterns, faded and worn with age. It was beautiful in a haunting sort of way, and I started snapping pictures to distract myself from the growing unease in my chest. That's when I noticed it, the silence. It wasn't just quiet, it was absolute. No dripping water, no rustling air, no sound of my own breathing. I paused, shining the flashlight around, trying to convince myself I was imagining it. But then I heard it, a faint shuffling sound coming from behind me. I whipped around, expecting to see Shabir, but the tunnel was empty. "Hello," I called out, my voice cracking. No response. I told myself it was probably just a rat or a stray draft, but my hands were shaking as I gripped the flashlight tighter. I kept walking, faster now, trying to get this over with, but the shuffling sound didn't stop. It stayed behind me, always just out of sight, no matter how many times I turned around. And then it started to change. It wasn't shuffling anymore. It was footsteps, slow, deliberate footsteps, echoing too loud in the silent tunnel. I don't know why I didn't run. Maybe I was too scared. Maybe some part of me still thought it was all in my head. But then I saw it. The beam of my flashlight landed on something up ahead. At first I thought it was just a shadow, but then it moved. It was a figure, standing in the middle of the tunnel, facing away from me. It was dressed in what looked like an old British military uniform, torn and rotting, the kind you'd expect to see in a museum. Its skin was pale and stretched tight over its bones, and its head was tilted at an unnatural angle, like its neck had been snapped. I froze. My brain was screaming at me to turn around, to run, but my legs wouldn't move. The figure didn't turn around. It just stood there for what felt like an eternity. And then, slowly, it began to turn. I didn't wait to see its face. I don't think I could have handled it. I dropped my camera and ran, stumbling over loose stones and gasping for air. The footsteps behind me started again, faster this time, almost running. But they didn't sound human anymore. They were heavier, uneven, like whatever was chasing me was limping. When I finally reached the entrance, Shabir was gone. The gate was still open, and I burst out into the daylight, collapsing on the ground outside. My chest was heaving, my heart pounding so hard it felt like it would explode. I didn't look back. I never went back to that palace. Story 4. It happened 3 years ago, during a camping trip in the rainforest near Yandabike, Malaysia. My name is Ismail, and I grew up in Kuala Lumpur, so I've always heard stories about the Bunyan. My grandmother used to say they were beautiful, pale-skinned beings who lived in hidden villages deep in the jungle. But she always warned, "If you see something strange, do not speak of it," and always ask for permission before entering the forest. I didn't take her words seriously back then, but after what happened, I don't think I'll ever step into the jungle again. My friend Adam and I had planned the trip as a quick escape from city life. We packed light, just a tent, some food, and a couple of flashlights. We weren't exactly experienced campers, but the area wasn't supposed to be too remote. We parked the car on the side of a narrow dirt road, hiked about an hour into the forest, and found a clearing by a small stream. It was perfect, secluded, quiet, and shaded by massive trees. The first few hours were uneventful. We set up the tent, started a small fire, and cooked some instant noodles. Adib kept joking about ghost stories, trying to spook me, but I wasn't in the mood. There was something about the air. It felt heavy, like it was pressing down on my chest. And the forest was too quiet. No crickets, no frogs, no rustling leaves. Just silence. I tried to shake it off, blaming it on nerves or maybe exhaustion from the hike. As the sun set, the atmosphere grew even more unsettling. The sky was a deep, inky black, and the firelight barely illuminated the trees around us. Around 10 p.m., Adib suggested we explore a bit before calling it a night. I hesitated but didn't want to seem like a coward, so I agreed. We grabbed our flashlights and started walking upstream. The beam of light from the flashlight felt weak, swallowed up by the darkness. Every step we took seemed louder than it should have been, crunching against the leaves and twigs. About 10 minutes in, we came across a small stone structure. It looked ancient, moss-covered, weathered, and barely standing. It wasn't big, maybe the size of a small shed, and there were carvings on the stones that I couldn't recognize. Adib, being the curious idiot he is, wanted to take a closer look. "This is probably some old Orang Asli shrine or something," he said, shining his flashlight over the carvings. I felt uneasy immediately. Something about the place felt wrong, like we weren't supposed to be there. "Adib, let's go back," I said, my voice shaking. "Relax, man, it's just stones," he replied, brushing off my concerns. That's when I noticed it. The forest around us had gone deathly silent. No wind, no insects, nothing. Just an oppressive, unnatural stillness. My heart started pounding, and every instinct in my body screamed at me to leave. "Adib," I whispered harshly. "Let's go. Now." He sighed but finally turned to follow me back. As we started walking, I heard it, a faint, melodic humming. It sounded like a woman's voice, soft and haunting. I froze, gripping Adib's arm. "Did you hear that?" I asked. He nodded, his face pale. We both turned our flashlights in the direction of the sound, and that's when we saw her. A woman stood about 20 feet away, just on the edge of the flashlight's beam. She was dressed in a long white kabaya, her skin impossibly pale, almost glowing in the dark. Her black hair fell to her waist and she stood perfectly still, her face obscured by the shadows. The humming grew louder, but her lips didn't move. Who are you?" Adib stammered, his voice barely audible. She tilted her head slightly, like she was studying us. Then, without warning, she took a step forward. Her movement was smooth, almost gliding, and my blood turned to ice. Adib grabbed my arm and whispered, "Run!" We turned and bolted, crashing through the undergrowth in blind panic. The humming followed us, growing louder and more distorted, like it was inside my head. I didn't dare look back, but I could feel her presence, close and unrelenting. When we reached the clearing, our campsite was gone. The tent, the fire pit, everything was just missing. It was like we had never been there. Adib and I stared at each other, both of us gasping for breath, too terrified to speak. "We're lost," he finally whispered. "No, the stream. We just need to follow the stream back," I said, trying to keep calm. But when we turned to look, the stream was gone too. In its place was a dense wall of trees that hadn't been there before. I don't know how long we wandered. Minutes? Hours? Time felt meaningless in that suffocating darkness. The humming never stopped, though it seemed to come from everywhere at once. At some point, Adib started mumbling under his breath, repeating a prayer over and over. I joined him, clutching the small pendant my grandmother had given me when I was a child. "Please, please let us go," I whispered, tears streaming down my face. And then, just as suddenly as it started, the humming stopped. The forest around us seemed to exhale, and the oppressive air lifted. We stumbled forward and broke through the tree line, back onto the dirt road where our car was parked. The headlights were still on, and the engine was running, though I swear we had turned it off. Without a word, we jumped into the car and sped off, not daring to look back. It wasn't until we were miles away that Adib finally spoke. "We're never going back there," he said, his voice hollow. I nodded, unable to speak. Even now, I can't explain what happened that night, but I know one thing for sure. My grandmother was right. Some places are not meant for us to disturb. Story 5. I grew up in a small village in the middle of a dense tropical rainforest. When I say small, I mean everyone knew everyone, and there wasn't much happening unless you went looking for it. My name's Sidi, by the way. I'm 34 now and live in the city, but I haven't been back to my village in years. Not since, well, you'll understand in a bit. Growing up, we all heard stories about the Kayu people, the wooden ones. Every elder in our village would warn us not to go too deep into the forest. There was this specific patch of trees, older than any of us could guess, that the grown-ups always said was where the wooden ones lived. They were supposed to be just like us, with their own version of our village, living our lives but made of wood. And if you stumbled upon them by accident, they would swap with you. The scariest part? They weren't evil or vengeful. They didn't want to replace you. They had to. That's just the way it worked. And when it happened, you'd become one of them, made of wood, hollow inside, forced to live out their endless wooden lives. Meanwhile, your wooden self would take your place in the village, and no one would know the difference, except for you, trapped forever. I used to think it was just a story to keep kids from wandering off. I mean, it worked for the most part. None of us wanted to test it. But one day I learned the truth the hard way. It happened when I was 17. My cousin Amir had come to stay with us from the city. He was one of those guys who always had something to prove. You know the type, always bragging about how tough he was or how nothing scared him. He laughed at all the village stories. "Wooden people? Seriously? You all believe in this crap?" he said over and over. It got on my nerves. One afternoon, he dared me to go with him into the forest. I should have said no. I really should have. But back then, I hated looking weak, especially in front of Amir. So I told him I'd go, but only up to a certain point, the part where the trees changed. You could always tell. The air got heavier, the shadows stretched too far, and there was this smell like rotting wood. We left around noon, cutting through the bush with a machete Amir had borrowed from my uncle. At first it was fine, just birds and insects, same as always. But about an hour in, I started to notice the silence, the kind that presses against your ears, the kind that tells you to turn around. "We're close," Amir said, grinning like an idiot. He was sweating, but his eyes were full of that stupid bravado. I stopped walking. "This is far enough," I told him. "We need to go back." He laughed. "What? Scared of some wooden dolls?" "I'm serious, Amir. People don't come out here for a reason." But he just rolled his eyes and kept going. "Fine," I muttered. "Do what you want." I wasn't about to follow him any further. That's when I saw it. About 20 feet ahead, through the trees, there was a clearing. But it wasn't empty. There were houses there, tiny, crooked versions of the ones in our village. They looked like they'd been carved out of massive tree trunks, their windows hollowed out, their roofs covered in moss. And the smell? It hit me all at once, thick and sickly sweet, like sap mixed with decay. "Amir, stop!" I hissed, but he didn't. He was already stepping into the clearing. I tried to shout at him again, but the words caught in my throat, because they were there, the wooden ones. They looked exactly like us, but wrong. Their skin was bark, their joints creaked when they moved, and their eyes, oh God, their eyes were smooth and shiny like polished wood. They turned to look at Amir, and the way they moved made my stomach churn. Too stiff, too deliberate, like puppets with invisible strings. Amir froze. He saw them too. His grin vanished, and for a second, I thought he'd run. But before he could move, one of them stepped forward. It looked just like him. Same face, same clothes, same stupid smirk, but carved from wood. It raised a hand, and Amir did the same, like a mirror. "Amir!" I screamed. He turned to me, and for a split second, I saw the terror in his eyes. He opened his mouth to say something, but before he could, his body stiffened. His skin turned brown and cracked. His arms froze mid-motion, and his eyes, they turned glossy, like varnish. I swear I heard it. The creak of wood as he transformed. The wooden Amir stepped forward, its movements jerky but purposeful. It turned to me, its wooden lips parting in a smile that wasn't human. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. Then it spoke, in Amir's voice. "Let's go back," it said. I ran. I didn't look back. Not once. I crashed through the forest, branches cutting my arms, my legs aching with every step. When I finally made it back to the village, my parents found me trembling on the porch. "What happened? Where's Amir?" they asked. I couldn't answer. I just stared at the edge of the forest. And then I saw him, Amir, walking out of the trees like nothing had happened. He smiled at me. that same cocky grin, and said, "What's wrong with her?" No one believed me. Why would they? Amir acted normal after that. He laughed, joked, and even teased me about getting scared of shadows. But I knew it wasn't him. A week later, he left the village and never came back. Story 6, I'm Jaden, and I've lived in a small town in eastern Kentucky my whole life. Nothing much happens here. It's one of those places where everybody knows everybody, and gossip travels faster than the wind. Our town has a legend about the Wailing Woman, the ghost of an old mentally ill lady who's said to haunt the woods and sometimes wanders into town, crying and screaming on cold, windy nights. Folks swear they've heard her, but most of us figured it was just the wind whistling through the hollers. That's what I thought too, until last winter. It was late January, and a cold front had rolled in, bringing bitter winds that cut through your jacket like a knife. I was driving home from my shift at the diner around 10:30 p.m. My car heater was barely keeping up, and my breath fogged the windshield every time I exhaled. I lived just outside of town, a good 10-minute drive through back roads lined with dense woods on either side. That night, the darkness felt heavier than usual. My headlights barely pierced it, and the wind howling through the trees made the hairs on my neck stand on end. As I turned onto the final stretch of road leading to my place, I noticed something odd up ahead. There was a figure standing on the side of the road, right where the woods opened up into a small clearing. At first, I thought it was a deer, or maybe some drunk who'd wandered out of the holler. But as I got closer, I realized it was a woman. She wasn't moving, just standing there, staring at the ground. Her hair was long, tangled, and whipping around in the wind. She wasn't wearing a coat, just a thin white nightgown that clung to her like it was soaked. Her bare feet were planted in the snow, and I swear, even from a distance, I could see her skin turning blue. I slowed down, rolling to a stop a few yards away. My stomach twisted as I debated what to do. She looked too real to be a ghost, but who in their right mind would be out there like that? I cracked my window and called out, "Ma'am, are you all right? Do you need help?" She didn't answer. She didn't even look up. The only sound was the wind screaming through the trees. My gut told me to drive away, but I couldn't just leave her there to freeze to death. So against every instinct screaming at me to stay in the car, I grabbed my flashlight and got out. The cold hit me like a slap in the face, and the crunch of snow under my boots sounded deafening in the silence. "Ma'am?" I called again, shining the flashlight toward her. The beam caught her face and my blood ran cold. Her skin was pale, almost gray, and her eyes were wide open but glassy, like she wasn't seeing me at all. Her lips were cracked and blue, trembling as if she were muttering something under her breath. I couldn't make it out over the wind. I stepped closer, about 10 feet away now, and asked, "Ma'am, do you need me to call someone? Are you lost?" Still no answer. She just stood there, swaying slightly, her lips moving faster now. It sounded like a chant or a prayer, but it was too low for me to catch the words. I was about to take another step when she suddenly stopped. Her lips froze mid-whisper, and she lifted her head to look directly at me. Her eyes locked onto mine, and I swear, they weren't glassy anymore. They were black. Just black, like her pupils had swallowed everything. "Leave," she rasped, her voice barely louder than a whisper. It sounded raw, like her throat was shredded. That's when I noticed her hands. They were hanging limp at her sides, but her fingers were curled, nails digging into her palms so hard I could see blood dripping onto the snow. My stomach churned, and I stumbled back a step. The flashlight shook in my hand. "Ma'am, I'm just trying to help," I stammered, but my voice cracked. I didn't believe my own words anymore. Her head tilted to the side and a smile spread across her face, a wide, unnatural grin that made my skin crawl. Then she let out a sound I'll never forget. It started as a low moan, like she was in pain, but it grew louder and higher, turning into a wail that didn't sound human. It was piercing, guttural, and echoed through the woods like a scream tearing through the night. My fight or flight kicked in, and I bolted back to my car. I slipped on the ice, falling to my knees, but I scrambled up and dove into the driver's seat. My hands were shaking so bad I could barely get the key into the ignition. When the engine finally roared to life, I slammed it into reverse, my headlights swinging wildly across the clearing. That's when I saw her again. She was standing in the middle of the road now, her arms stretched out to her sides. Her mouth was still open, wailing, but her face, God, her face looked like it was peeling, the skin pulling back as if something underneath was trying to claw its way out. I didn't think. I just gunned it. The car fishtailed as I sped past her, my tires kicking up snow. I didn't look back. I couldn't. My heart was pounding so hard I thought it might burst. When I finally made it home, I locked every door and window, turned on every light, and sat in the corner of my living room, clutching a baseball bat. I didn't sleep that night. Hell, I didn't sleep for days. I don't know what I saw that night. Story 7. I was 16 when I saw the Cadejo. I'm from a small village in El Salvador, about an hour from San Miguel. It's not much, mostly farmers, dirt roads, and a single tiny store run out of Doña Marta's house. My family's home was at the edge of the village, where the farmland stretched out toward the hills. That's where it happened. It was late, maybe around 11. My mom had asked me to check on our chickens because something had been stealing eggs. Probably a fox or a possum, we thought. I was annoyed, but I grabbed my flashlight and went out anyway. The air was heavy and still. You know that kind of silence that feels like the whole world's holding its breath? That's what it was like. No wind, no crickets, just quiet. The chicken coop wasn't far, maybe 20 meters from the house. I remember clicking on the flashlight and shining it around as I walked. The beam cut through the dark, but everything outside the light felt too big, too empty. When I reached the coop, the door was open. Not wide, just a crack, like someone had slipped in. I froze. We'd locked it earlier, I was sure. My first thought was maybe one of the neighbors was messing around, but that didn't make sense. Everyone around here kept to themselves. I stepped closer, slowly, and pushed the door open with my foot. The smell hit me first. Not just chicken, but something earthy, almost like wet fur and rotten leaves. My flashlight flickered. I swear to God, I checked the batteries before I came out. Kinandahi, I called out. Who's there? Nothing. I stepped into the coop, my boots crunching against the straw. The chickens were dead silent. They weren't asleep, though. They were huddled in the corner, their beady eyes wide and locked on something behind me. That's when I heard it, this low, wet growl. Not like a dog or a coyote. It sounded too deep, too wrong. I spun around so fast I nearly dropped the flashlight. It was there. The first thing I noticed was its size. It was huge, bigger than any dog I'd ever seen. Its body was covered in shaggy black fur that seemed to shift in the light like shadows. The head was strange, almost like a dog's, but flatter. And its eyes, God, its eyes were glowing. Not like the way an animal's eyes reflect light. These burned like embers in a dying fire. But the legs were the worst. They didn't match. Its front legs were long and thick, like a mastiff's, but the back ones were smaller, crooked almost like a rabbit's. The way it stood there staring at me, it looked ready to lunge. I couldn't move. My legs locked up, my chest was tight, and my heart was pounding so hard I could hear it in my ears. It tilted its head just slightly, and then it bared its teeth. Dios mío, I whispered, barely able to get the words out. The thing didn't make a sound. It just took one step forward, slow and deliberate, like it knew I wasn't going anywhere. I remembered my grandma's stories about the Cadejo, how there were two of them, one white and one black. The white one was a protector, but the black one, it was evil. It followed drunkards, thieves, and liars, and it didn't just kill you, it stole your soul. I wasn't drunk, I hadn't stolen anything, but maybe it knew something I didn't. I took a step back, and the thing growled again, low and vibrating in my chest. My flashlight flickered again, then died completely. Please, I whispered, though I wasn't sure who I was talking to. God? The Cadejo? Myself? Then just as I thought it would pounce, it stopped. It sniffed the air, turning its head slightly, and then it stepped back into the shadows. For a moment I thought it was gone, but then I saw its eyes again, those burning embers, just watching me from the darkness. I didn't run. I couldn't. My legs felt like they were made of stone. I backed out of the coop slowly, keeping my eyes on those glowing orbs the whole time. When I reached the yard, I tripped over something and fell hard onto my back. When I looked up, it was standing at the edge of the light from our house. It didn't move, didn't growl, didn't blink. It just stood there, staring. Then it turned and walked off, its strange legs moving in this jerky, unnatural way. I stayed on the ground, too scared to even breathe until it was completely gone. When I finally got back inside, my mom was sitting at the table, sipping coffee like nothing had happened. "Todo bien?" she asked, raising an eyebrow. I didn't tell her. Not then, not for years. What would I say? That I'd seen something out of a nightmare? And I pray it never finds me again. Story 8. I've lived in Quezon City my whole life, and like most people here, I've heard the stories. We all have. Every street has its own urban legend. The crying baby in the empty lot, the Mananangal sightings behind that one barangay hall, the faceless woman at the park. But the one that stuck with me since I was a teenager is the White Lady of Balit Drive. You don't even have to believe in ghosts to know about her. People talk about it like it's just a fact. Don't drive alone down Balit Drive at night. For the longest time, I thought it was just a story, until last year. I was coming home late from work. It was around 1:30 in the morning. I'd stayed overtime trying to finish a project, and by the time I left the office, the streets were practically empty. Quezon City is quieter than you'd think that late at night. Just the occasional jeepney or tricycle. My route home takes me past Balit Drive, but I didn't think twice about it. I mean, why would I? I'd taken that street hundreds of times before. I remember glancing at my phone before the turn. It was 1:47 a.m. The streetlights on Balit were dim as always, flickering in some spots. The branches of the massive Balit trees overhead cast strange shadows on the pavement, like long fingers stretching across the road. My radio wasn't working, so it was just me, the hum of the engine, and the crunch of gravel under my tires. I was maybe halfway down the street when I felt it. This coldness, not from the aircon, but something else. It crept up my back and wrapped around my shoulders, heavy and suffocating. I brushed it off as being tired. I hadn't slept much the night before, and I figured my mind was just playing tricks on me. Then I smelled it, a faint, sweet scent, like sampaguita flowers, but off somehow, like they'd been sitting in the stagnant water. The smell was so strong, it made my stomach turn. I rolled down the window to get some fresh air, but the smell didn't go away. In fact, it seemed stronger now, like it was coming from inside the car. That's when I glanced at the rearview mirror. I froze. There was someone sitting in the back seat. She was dressed all in white, her long black hair covering most of her face. I couldn't see her eyes, just pale, almost grayish skin, in the faint outline of a smile. Her hands were resting on her lap, the fingers thin and unnaturally long. She wasn't moving, but she was there, sitting in the seat behind me. I don't know how long I stared. My heart was pounding so loud I could barely hear anything else. I wanted to turn around to confirm that what I was seeing wasn't real, but I couldn't. It was like my body refused to move. And then she moved, not much, just a small tilt of her head, like she knew I was looking at her. That faint smile widened, and I swear to God, it was the most unnatural, horrifying thing I've ever seen. I couldn't breathe. My hands were gripping the steering wheel so tightly that my knuckles were white. I don't know what made me snap out of it, but I did. My foot slammed down on the accelerator, and the car lurched forward. I didn't care about the speed limit or the potholes. I just wanted to get the hell off that street. The smell of sampaguita was overpowering now, and I could feel her eyes, or whatever was behind that hair, watching me. I didn't look in the mirror again. I couldn't. I just kept driving, praying under my breath, muttering every prayer I could think of, even ones I didn't know I remembered. It felt like an eternity, but finally I saw the end of the street. The lights of East Rodriguez Avenue were ahead, brighter than I'd ever seen them. The moment I turned onto the main road, the coldness vanished. The smell was gone. I risked a glance at the rearview mirror, and the back seat was empty. I pulled over at a gas station a few blocks away, my hands shaking so badly I couldn't even take the key out of the ignition. I sat there for what felt like hours, trying to calm down, trying to convince myself that it didn't happen. But no matter how much I wanted to believe it was just my imagination, I couldn't forget that smile. I haven't taken Bolete Drive since. Story 9. I grew up in a small town in eastern Kentucky. It's the kind of place where everyone knows everyone else's business, and the kids entertain themselves with dares and urban legends. About 2 miles outside of town, there's an old dirt road that cuts straight into the woods. It's unmarked, barely wide enough for one car, and overgrown on both sides. At the very end of that road sits the ruins of an old church, abandoned for decades. In high school, it became this stupid rite of passage. Kids would drive out there late at night, park in front of the church, and just sit. You were supposed to see how long you could last before chickening out. People claimed they heard chanting, saw figures in the windows, or felt their car being pushed when no one was around. It was all nonsense. Just a way for bored kids to scare themselves. I was 16 the first time I went out there. My best friend Derek was driving his mom's old Camry, and our other friend Rachel was in the back seat. It was a Friday night, and there wasn't much else to do, so we decided to test our nerves. We hit the dirt road around 11 p.m. The woods swallowed us almost immediately, the trees so dense that even the moonlight couldn't cut through. Derek killed the radio, and the only sound was the crunch of gravel under the tires. "You guys scared yet?" Derek asked, trying to sound casual, but I could hear the edge in his voice. "Scared of what?" I shot back. "Some broken windows and peeling paint?" Rachel stayed quiet in the back, her face lit by her phone screen as she pretended to be disinterested. When we finally reached the church, I felt a little knot tighten in my stomach. It wasn't much to look at, just a crumbling brick building with a collapsed steeple and boarded up windows. But there was something about it, something that made the air feel heavier. Derek pulled up right in front and killed the engine. The sudden silence was deafening. "All right," he said, gripping the wheel. "Let's see how long we last." We sat there, the three of us, not saying much. I don't know what I expected to happen. Maybe for someone to jump out of the woods with a flashlight and yell, "Boo!" But nothing did. The longer we sat, the more I felt that knot in my stomach tighten. "Okay," Rachel said after a while. "This is boring. Can we go now?" "No way," Derek said. "We just got here." Rachel rolled her eyes and went back to her phone. That's when I noticed it. At first, I thought it was just the shadows playing tricks on me. But then I saw it again. Movement in one of the church's broken windows. "Did you see that?" I asked, leaning forward. "See what?" Derek said. "In the window," I said, pointing. "There's something..." I stopped. A figure was standing there, just behind the jagged glass. It wasn't clear enough to make out any details, but it was definitely a person. "I'm not crazy," I said, my voice shaking. "There's someone in there." Derek and Rachel both turned to look. "I don't see..." Derek started, but then he froze. "Oh, shit." Rachel dropped her phone and leaned between the seats to get a better look. "What the hell is that?" she whispered. The figure didn't move, just stood there watching us. My heart was pounding so hard I thought it might burst. "Okay, let's go," I said, my voice rising. "Derek, start the car." He didn't move. "Derek," I snapped, "start the damn car." He fumbled for the keys, his hands shaking so badly he almost dropped them. Just as he turned the ignition, the figure moved, fast. 1 second it was in the window, and the next it was gone. "Where did it go?" Rachel whispered, her voice barely audible. The engine roared to life, and Derek slammed the car into reverse. As we backed away, the headlights swept across the church, and that's when we saw it. It was standing in the doorway now, just outside the church. It was taller than I expected, its shoulders hunched and its head cocked to the side, like it was studying us. "What the fuck is that?" Derek yelled, his foot slamming on the gas. The car lurched backward, and I turned to look out the rear window. My blood ran cold. It was running after us. I don't know how to describe the way it moved. It wasn't human. Its arms and legs bent in ways that didn't make sense, like a marionette being yanked on strings. "Go, go, go!" Rachel screamed, her hands gripping the back of my seat. The tires skidded on the gravel as Derek whipped the car around and sped down the dirt road. I kept looking back, my breath coming in short, panicked gasps. It was still chasing us, its movements jerky and unnatural, but it was fast, faster than it should have been. We hit the main road and didn't stop until we were back in town. Derek pulled into the parking lot of a gas station and killed the engine, his hand still gripping the wheel. No one said anything for a long time. We just sat there, breathing hard, trying to process what had just happened. Finally, Rachel broke the silence. "What the hell was that thing?" None of us had an answer. We didn't go back to the church after that. Story 10. It was a quiet night, too quiet, the kind of night where the air feels thick, like something's waiting, but you can't tell what. I was on a date with my boyfriend Tom out in the woods. We didn't have a specific destination. We were just driving around, talking about stupid stuff, playing music. At some point, we found ourselves on a dead-end road. It was one of those roads that made you feel like you were somewhere you shouldn't be. Trees crowded the way, and the pavement was cracked and uneven. The kind of road people don't take unless they have to. We stopped the car, pulled over to the side. The headlights cut through the dark, and it felt like we were the only two people alive. Tom didn't seem to mind. He pulled the keys out, tossed them to me, and leaned back against the seat, looking up at the stars. "You want to get out?" he asked. "Why not?" "Just for a minute. I figured it'd be nice. Get some air, stretch my legs." We walked around the car, just talking, laughing. Then eventually he went to the front and started messing with the hood. "I think the gas gauge is broken," he said. "Looks like we're stuck here." I laughed. "Seriously? You have a full tank like 10 miles ago." "Guess I'm walking to get more," he said, grinning. "You sure?" I asked. "It's kind of late for that. Why don't we just call a tow truck or something?" He shrugged. "Nah, it'll be faster. Stay here, lock the door." I didn't argue, just nodded as he started walking down the road. The way his figure disappeared into the darkness made the woods feel even quieter. I locked the doors, started fiddling with the radio. The minutes started dragging by. 10 minutes, then 15. I checked my phone, but there was no signal out here. Not that I was really expecting one. The longer I sat there, the more off it felt. I tried to focus on the road ahead, listening to the hum of the engine, the soft music playing from the speakers. But every little sound seemed magnified in that silence. A branch creaked somewhere deep in the woods. The wind rustled the leaves.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
But it was the sound of something scraping against the roof that got to me. At first, I thought it was just the wind, or maybe a branch. I turned the music down, trying to listen more closely. Then the sound came again, a knock, followed by a scratch. I froze. It wasn't a branch. It was something else. I glanced around, half expecting to see Tom come back out of the trees, laughing like he was playing a joke on me. But nothing. Just the dark, thick woods. The sound came again, a scrape, followed by another knock, then another. It sounded like someone was tapping their knuckles against the roof of the car. I looked at the rearview mirror, expecting to see Tom walking back, but still nothing. Only the deep shadows of the trees and that noise, like someone knocking softly, methodically. Drip, drip, drip. That's when I realized it wasn't just the sound of tapping. It was a rhythm, and it was wet, like something was dripping on the roof. I couldn't sit still anymore. I unlocked the door and stepped out, my heart racing. The air felt colder than before. My breath was shallow as I stared up at the roof of the car, trying to make sense of the noise. The sound of dripping was louder now. Something wet splashed against the top of the car with each drop. I took a step back, squinting into the dark sky, and that's when I saw it. Tom wasn't walking back from the road. He was hanging. I saw his body, stretched out, suspended from the branches of a tree nearby. His arms were twisted behind his back, his legs at weird angles. His body was inside out. I could barely breathe as I stared at what was left of him. His face, his stomach, everything was wrong. And his hands. His knuckles were scraping against the roof of the car, knocking softly like he was trying to get my attention. Blood was dripping onto the car in slow, steady drops, each one splashing against the roof. I stumbled backward, gasping. I couldn't scream, couldn't move. My body was frozen, my mind was screaming, telling me to run, but my feet wouldn't listen. I looked at the tree again, but Tom was still there. His body, wrong, hanging like that. He shouldn't have been able to move. But those knocks, that dripping, they kept coming. It was as if his body was still alive, still trying to reach me, even though it was twisted in the most unnatural way. I don't know how long I stood there, just staring at him. It felt like hours, but I know it wasn't. My head was spinning. I couldn't process it, couldn't understand what I was seeing. Was I dreaming? Was this a nightmare? Then there was a sound from behind me, footsteps crunching on the gravel. I spun around, heart pounding in my chest. My legs felt like jelly, but I still somehow managed to turn. Nothing. I was alone again. But I didn't feel alone. I felt watched. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. I couldn't get back into the car fast enough. My fingers fumbled with the door handle, my heart in my throat, the air thick with fear. I slammed the door shut, locked it again, my hands shaking so hard I could barely keep the key steady. The knocking on the roof was louder now, more frantic. Blood dripped onto the windshield, streaking down, pooling on the glass. I didn't know what to do, where to go, or how to leave. I was trapped, trapped in a nightmare I couldn't wake up from. The last thing I remember is the sound of those knuckles on the roof, scraping, scraping, knocking. Then I woke up the next morning, still in the car, the sun just starting to rise. I couldn't remember falling asleep. I couldn't remember how I got there. But I was alone now. No blood, no Tom, nothing. Just the empty road stretching out before me. I don't know if I'll ever understand what happened that night, but I know one thing for sure. I'll never drive down a dead-end road again. Not in these woods, not alone. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.